Three things shaped identity in late medieval Europe: kin, place, and religion. When the Reformation broke apart Western European Christianity for the first time in 1,000 years, the balance of that trio was skewed. So religion assumed a much greater importance because for many it came to involve choice. For few people is that more true than for Thomas Cromwell. His choices were momentous because they helped to decide the future of English Christianity. And that's my main subject in these four lectures. But we need to keep an eye on those other components of identity, kin and place, if we seek to understand this fascinating, complex man and the brief public career in which he seized the destiny of the Kingdom of England. Cromwell's destiny of service, decade of service to Henry VIII in the 1530s, can only be understood if we probe what we can recover of what went before, and that's the bulk of what I want to say today. Cromwell was famously the self-made boy from Putney, but in fact, he had a role model there, a lad called Nicholas West, about a quarter century older than him. West was a bright boy, so he left his birthplace and had a wild youth doing shocking things, actually more shocking than Cromwell, since as an undergraduate he set fire to the provost's lodgings of King's College, Cambridge. But he went on to become a man of great account, to make his family proud, and rose very high in the affairs of the kingdom. He became Bishop of Ely. The bishop shared Cromwell's fixation with his childhood home, so we can still enjoy viewing his splendid, if much altered, chantry chapel as part of Putney Parish Church. Now, when the relationship of Bishop West and Master Secretary Cromwell had utterly changed, and West found himself on the wrong side of Henry VIII's temper in 1533, he reminded Cromwell of their common origins, as you would. "Thus I am bold to write unto you, desiring your favour, and rather moved thereunto because of our native country," by which he meant Surrey, "and that we be God-brothers." Yet, in religious outlook, Bishop West and Cromwell proved not to be soulmates, as might have been predicted from West's lavish traditional chantry provision, not just in Putney but in Ely Cathedral. The bishop was among the foremost opponents of Lutheranism from its first arrival in England in the early 1520s. Now, my main argument in these lectures will be that Thomas Cromwell's religious views were a constant force in shaping his public career and policy, and that from the early 1530s, they were what a later generation would call Protestant. Now, that term is best put aside in dealing with these very early stages of the English Reformation. So I'm going to talk about evangelicalism all the time. It fits much better. In Cromwell's lifetime, Protestant was not a term used to describe English adherents of the Reformation, and it's best reserved for its place of origin in Germany. By contrast, the terms evangelic or evangelical were used in England at the time, and that's the usage which I will generally adopt. Well, despite these two men's religious differences, the Putney connection proved potent. When Bishop West died in 1533, he was succeeded as Bishop of Ely by Thomas Goodrick, one of England's first unmistakably evangelical bishops. A boyhood friend of the most highly placed evangelical clergyman of all, Thomas Cranmer, by then Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, one would have expected Cromwell, the evangelical, to have found a natural sympathy with Goodrick, but the reverse proved to be the case. Alas for the new Bishop Goodrick, family links continued to trump religious affiliation. Nicholas West had entrenched his nephew and employee, Thomas Meggs, in an important diocesan stewardship, and Goodrick could not get rid of him. The new bishop found himself ranged against a Putney affinity in the Isle of Ely, who owed their social position to Bishop West's clerical career, but who now sustained it through their link with a second Putney lad, Thomas Cromwell. He was probably much the same age as Thomas Meggs, and they may have known each other as boys. In any case, before his death, West made a point of recommending Meggs as his business agent to Cromwell, and the relationship blossomed. Bishop Goodrick's origins in a lesser gentry family of Lincolnshire had given him a more elevated start in Tudor society than either Nicholas West or Thomas Cromwell. But now he was at a decided disadvantage in dealing with the legacy of his episcopal predecessor in the malign shape of Thomas Meggs. A long series of conflicts developed between the increasingly infuriated bishop and his unwanted official, who drew on Cromwell's support with consistent success, despite a stream of letters from both parties vying for the royal minister's favour. In 1537, Bishop Goodrick's frustration exploded after Cromwell's nephew, Richard Cromwell, visited him to impart the appalling news that Meggs had made over his Ely diocesan stewardship jointly to Richard himself and to Thomas Cromwell's own son, Gregory. This key episcopal office thus continued irretrievably beyond the bishop's control. Richard enjoyed describing to his uncle the bishop's impotent rage. Let's not forget, then, that contradictory pull of place and kin in picking up the strands of Cromwell's adult career. Famously, he fled England for Italy in his teens, and there he became thoroughly familiar with and fascinated by Italian society. Throughout his life, he read Italian literature for pleasure. That time in Italy set him up with contacts in the world of international trade, which continued when he came home to a mixed career of legal conveyancing and commerce. Italy got him his first big career break in Boston, in Lincolnshire. Once more, at the end of the 1510s, that took him back to Italy, a consultancy for the extremely wealthy and expanding Guild of Our Lady of Boston. Originally, this guild had been a fairly modest body with a local focus, but in the early 1500s, it may have become the largest such operation in all England, and we can still see its stately side chapel in one of England's most prodigious parish churches. And if the Boston stump of the parish church triumphantly sees off all competition among rival Lincolnshire parish church towers, the same was not true of the Boston Guild's indulgence trade. Its profits needed constant defense against rival indulgence enterprises, particularly the equally expansionist salesmanship of the English province of the Austin Friars, or, as they were known in the Germany of Martin Luther, the Augustinian Eremites. In early 1517, a few months before Friar Luther started his fateful campaign against indulgences far away in Germany, thus inadvertently launching the Protestant Reformation, a battle royal broke out between his English brethren, the Austin Friars, and the Boston Guild, over control of the English indulgence market. Boston sent its guild clerk to Cardinal Wolsey to seek a suspension of the Austin's privileges. Yet even Wolsey, in his legatine splendor, was only a local representative of the Holy Father himself. As part of an even more ambitious campaign, the guild recruited Thomas Cromwell. In their determination to secure more documents of reaffirmation and authorization directly from the Pope himself. And the following accounting year, Whitsun 1518 to 19, Cromwell undertook this much more ambitious task in the Boston Guild's campaign. He went along with the Guild secretary, on an expedition to Rome itself. And this included the famous occasion on which John Fox depicts Cromwell as securing the renewal of Boston's bulls by charming the Pope with the aid of fine dishes of English jelly, serenaded by a group of singers demonstrating English three-part harmony. So the delighted Pope authorized the new bulls on the hunting field. Well, the irony is obvious. Cromwell, the future architect of English Reformation, was an agent in advancing the indulgence trade. In the very years when Martin Luther was denouncing it, though of course there was an equal irony that the great rivals of his employers in indulgence peddling were the Austin Friars, Luther's own order. John Fox wrote up Cromwell's career in Acts and Monuments, The Story of a Hero. Fox was himself born in Boston around a year before Cromwell's popish expedition, and he felt very uncomfortable about this story. But as a good historian, he could hardly ignore it, seeing he had rich reminiscences about it from the ultimate primary source, Cromwell himself, talking to Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, who'd relayed it to his secretary, Ralph Morris, coincidentally another Boston boy. Fox, however, did take relief in a reminiscence which likewise came to him from Morris. This was Cromwell's remark to Cranmer that he'd spent his time on the Roman expedition getting acquainted with Desiderius Erasmus's newly published Greek and Latin New Testament, and this work first set off doubts in his mind about what he was doing. This cheering thought Fox repeated twice. Whatever immediate effect Erasmus had on Cromwell, and there's no reason to doubt this story, the Anglo-Italian lawyer's dealings with Boston Guild were not over then. One letter in Cromwell's archive, which can be dated no more closely than between 1520 and 1523, shows that he acted as an agent for securing a new print run of 4,000 indulgences and as many publicity letters from the Guild's customary London printer, Richard Pinson. Pinson, in a generously ecumenical spirit of entrepreneurship, also printed the Austin Friars indulgence as well. May it be significant, in view of Cromwell's later interest in religious reform, that throughout his long relationship with Boston, he never availed himself of the opportunity of joining the extensive and in some ways, distinguished membership of the Guild itself, Our Lady's Guild. He never became a member. His professional work for such an extrovert expression of traditional piety as the Guild is no particular bar to supposing that he was becoming precociously involved in the developing Reformation. And the recent rediscovery of a stray from his archive provides an interesting parallel case from exactly the same stage of his career in the early 1520s. Among the many contract negotiations which he undertook for London merchants, there remains a draft agreement of 1522 to build a new aisle to house a chantry altar in the Bedfordshire parish church of Bidnam. The client was the local squire, contracting with a St. Albans Freemason in partnership with Cromwell's close friend Thomas Summer, a London stockfish merchant. Now, despite Summer's financial involvement in this eminently traditional chantry project, Summer's evangelical credentials proved impeccable to the extent of what amounted to martyrdom for his faith. He was a member of the shadowy dissident group known as the Christian Brethren. He was punished in 1530 for owning a copy of William Tyndale's New Testament translation, and he died in prison. In these first stages of the English Reformation, religious boundaries were still yet to be defined clearly, particularly when people were balancing sincerely held but evolving religious belief with lucrative careers. And the Christian name of Cromwell's only son is also worthy of note, Gregory. It's not been much remarked what an odd name Gregory is in early Tudor England. And yet, not only Thomas's son, but in the same generations, one of Thomas Cromwell's nephews was also called Gregory. Now, is it too fanciful to see the baby son born around 1520 as being named commemoratively after Cromwell's visit to Rome in 1518-19 in honour of Pope Gregory the Great? Gregory was the pope who sent Augustine to the Anglo-Saxons, and hence, as Professor Foote well knows, he was known as the Apostle of the English. Once more, we have to remember the fluidity of the Reformation in its first half decade. There's no reason to project backwards a fully formed version of Cromwell's undoubted later anti-papal outlook onto Boston's legal consultant when Gregory was christened. Boston itself was not quite what it seemed, as we will see as we move on to another significant moment in Cromwell's developing career in the 1520s. His employment in 1524 by Cardinal Thomas Wolsey. Now, this was one of the most central relationships in Cromwell's life. He clearly adored Wolsey, aggressively adopting a close version of his heraldry after the cardinal's death, when to do so was a brave and pointed gesture. There it is, and you're going to see it for the next four lectures. Effectively, he became Wolsey's kin, and certainly took care in looking after Wolsey's kin by blood, such as the cardinal's talentless illegitimate son, Thomas Winter. What did Wolsey want from Thomas Cromwell, apart from a decent jobbing lawyer, of whom there were swarms to choose from? The answer is the cardinal's legacy project, a monstrous tomb for himself, outclassing the tombs of kings, plus a pair of memorial chantry colleges at Ipswich and Oxford. Only a month after joining Wolsey's staff, Cromwell was off on what became extensive travels, bearing the cardinal's authority as papal legate to close down small monasteries and nunneries, whose surrendered assets were to be the chief finance for Wolsey's vast enterprise. All through Cromwell's time in Wolsey's service, it was this legacy project that formed his chief work for the cardinal. As the cardinal said to him, amidst the agony of disgrace and vanishing power in 1530, the colleges had become, in a manner, opera manuum tuarum, the work of your own hands. Right up to Wolsey's last months, Cromwell's chief business remained helping the cardinal to shepherd his soul into the next life. Historians have looked at Cromwell's occupation on this the wrong way round. Seduced by the very large amount of archive material about the dissolution of monasteries which funded the two colleges, we have not paid enough attention to Cardinal Wolsey's tomb. That is the key to Cromwell's employment. It was the Anglo-Italian whom Wolsey wanted to acquire, to negotiate effectively with the Italian craftsman making this monument, designed to be of a splendour to eclipse the tombs of kings. Nevertheless, Cromwell's new responsibilities famously put him in charge of dissolving those small monasteries, and that brought several new dimensions to his life. The cosmopolitan European traveller had a fairly limited acquaintance with his own country, largely London, Surrey, and Essex, and the ports of Southampton and Bristol. Now, he was given the chance to roam widely on travel expenses across the whole of lowland England. He could use his considerable charm to make all sorts of interesting friendships, which would be of huge value to him in his years serving Henry VIII. And it meant that just at the moment when the kingdom was beginning to divide on religious lines between traditionalists and evangelicals, Cromwell came to the king's service on the fall of Wolsey, equipped with a range of acquaintance on both sides of the religious gulf. In East Anglia, for instance, Cromwell had previously known few people north of Essex. That was to change with the erection of Cardinal College Ipswich, feeder school for Cardinal College in the University of Oxford. Cromwell's central role in creating the Ipswich College threw him into the company of East Anglians who were in Wolsey's service. What started as business relationships blossomed into real friendship, especially the Suffolk gentleman Thomas Rush and his stepson, Wolsey's servant Thomas Alvard. Now, what's very striking in this Rush-Alvard circle is that very few of its members went on to show enthusiasm for the developing Reformation. On the contrary, several were not afraid to be aggressively traditional. That did not stop them being numbered among Cromwell's friends, who went on expecting and getting favours. What bound them together was a shared reverence for the memory of Cardinal Wolsey. This ability to reach across the religious divide, despite his own very definite convictions, is a vital dimension of Cromwell's mastery of English government. Now, the historian of Lollardy, Andrew Hope, who I'm delighted to see here today, was the first to see the significance of a very different and directly contradictory outcome of Wolsey's legacy project, which takes us deeper into Cromwell's religious outlook in the late 1520s. At the centre of it was the extraordinary circumstance that in 1528, Wolsey's new foundation of Cardinal College, Oxford, was revealed as a nest of England's leading clerical converts to evangelical religion. They were mostly imports from Cambridge, and their exposure was a national sensation. Dr. John London, warden of New College, Oxford, wrote in frustration to the University Chancellor, Bishop of Lincoln, about John Clarke, one of the leading vipers in the Cardinal's bosom. "Would God my Lord's grace had never been motioned to call him or any other Cambridge man unto his most towardly college." But who was doing the motioning? It can only have been Cromwell. His involvement with Cardinal College, Oxford, did not end with setting it up, because from 1528 he was its receiver general and surveyor, and he clearly went on spending a lot of time there. He was the man to whom people turned to get places at the college the next few years. At the very least, Cromwell was responsible for the costs of bringing the evangelical scholars over from Cambridge. But he had so many personal contacts in Cambridge University that he could easily make informed choices in recruitment. The arrival of so many suspect men at Cardinal College was neither accident nor carelessness. There could have been quite different recruits from Cambridge. We know of at least one traditionalist-minded Cambridge don who refused to accept the siren call to Oxford. His name was Thomas Cranmer. Several strands of evidence serve to reinforce this notion and bear witness to Cromwell nurturing the evangelical group once they arrived in Oxford. First is the remarkable resonance of this Oxford scandal with an earlier phase of Cromwell's career, Boston, which provided some of the actors in the Oxford affair. Boston was an odd place in the English Reformation, with much going on below its extrovert public religious life. The impressively long list of evangelical books from Germany and Switzerland that the Oxford authorities rounded up in 1528 might usefully and unobtrusively have entered England through the port of Boston. We've seen its guild as a symbol of some of the most demonstrative late medieval devotion in all England. But among the fleet of chaplains whom the guild employed on a short-term basis to fill up their round of masses in Michaelmas term 1521 was one William Tyndale, surely the future biblical translator. While in 1525, the guild accounts reveal a startling conjunction of later celebrated evangelical names in the musical and clerical staff. Robert Testwood, with John Taverner just up the road at Tattersall College, and among the clergy, Thomas Garrett, the master of Boston Grammar School, and Thomas Lawney. Of these four I've just named, Testwood became Master of the Choristers at Cardinal College, Ipswich, while Garrett, Lawney, and Taverner appeared in the new foundation of Cardinal College, Oxford. Garrett was, in fact, the leading actor in the 1528 scandal, though unlike most of the miscreants, he'd already been an Oxford man. These are Cromwell's choices. But there is more. One of the small religious houses which Thomas Cromwell dissolved for Wolsey in 1525 to add to Cardinal College's endowment was Poffley Priory, nestling in the Berkshire Downs, about 27 miles south of Oxford. Vivid snapshots of its dissolution and subsequent fate are provided in two letters to Cromwell from a local gentleman called Edward Fettyplace. And in his second letter, written just short of 2 years after Poffley's dissolution, Fettyplace complained that the cardinal scholars had thoughtlessly misused fittings while they'd been staying in the former priory in summer 1528. It's then clear from Dr. London's letter, already quoted, 1526, there was a second stay, which London talks about, in 1527, again in the summer. On this second occasion, thanks to London, we know that the reading of these students from Oxford was on specifically evangelical texts and was led by John Clark, canon of Cardinal College, and a former colleague of Thomas Cranmer at Jesus College, Cambridge. Clark was a ringleader in the Oxford evangelical circle. He was one of those who sickened and died in August 1528 while imprisoned in the college cellars for his religious misdemeanors. So, an early martyr for the English Reformation. And we have a letter from Clark himself, written to Cromwell in August, probably 1527. In it, he mentions a previous letter of his carried to Cromwell by another of the evangelical fellows of Cardinal College, no less a figure than that better-known early Reformation martyr, John Frith, another recruit from Cambridge. And there is still more about the Poffley adventures. Andrew Hope first drew attention to the man whom Cromwell employed to collect the rents at Poffley Priory for the college. This figure appears both in Cromwell's accounts for the priory and in the two letters from Edward Fettyplace to Cromwell. To Fettyplace, this man was consistently obstructive, nevertheless without earning dismissal from Cromwell. This man was a minor gentleman from nearby Hungerford, who boasted two surnames, not uncommon at the time, though on this occasion, both of them rather frustratingly capable of putting in different versions, and that's concealed the man from scrutiny, from historians. He was called John Hidden or Eden, alias Clydesdale, Glidesdale, or Ledsdale. And he was a Lollard. Those obstinate descendants of this dissenting group around John Wycliffe. Moreover, John Hidden had a sister, Alice. After two marriages and on the eve of a third to a local gentleman called Thomas Doyley, she was exceptionally rich, worth well over £1,000 in money and goods, plus lands. Alice appears in Fox's Book of Martyrs. She comes across in his documentation as one of the most charismatic Lollards in the Oxfordshire, Berkshire area. This rare example of a Lollard gentlewoman had a galvanizing effect on her three successive husbands and their families, in the last case, not in a good way. In 1527, the Court of Chancery was dragged in to shore up at least the legal side of the collapsing marriage of Alice and Thomas Doyley. The lawyer responsible for the paperwork in this enforced reconciliation between a Lollard wife and a traditionalist husband in the same year that Poffley was subverted by Oxford scholars on vacation was none other than Cardinal Wolsey's counselor, Thomas Cromwell. His partisanship for Alice was seen as odd. Another friend and colleague of his in Wolsey's service, a friend of Thomas Doyley's as well, reproached Cromwell in an otherwise very cordial letter with being much friendly to the woman in obtaining the same settlement. Poffley was not the only setting for Cromwell's contacts with Cambridge evangelicals and their various contacts among the Lollards. During 1527 to 28, he was near neighbour at his home in Austin Friars in London to one of the chief actors in the early English Reformation, the Austin Friar Robert Barnes. Barnes was arrested and imprisoned in 1526 for a reformist sermon preached in Cambridge at Christmas 1525, while prior of the Austin Friars in Cambridge. He bitterly denounced the church's wealth. Clearly, the Austin Friars were very divided at this time. Around 6 months in the Fleet Prison was the result of that. But then Barnes was transferred to a curiously open house arrest at the London House of the Austin Friars. While there, he was active in distributing copies of William Tyndale's New Testament and received a steady procession of visitors. It is inconceivable that Thomas Cromwell did not visit or know his evangelical neighbour during this time. It's tempting to wonder whether he had a hand in Barnes's move from the Fleet Prison to the Austin Friars. In the 1530s, unsurprisingly, Barnes became an eager client of Cromwell's, and they were both destined to die horribly in 1540. Yet, if that early connection with Barnes remains clouded in discretion, there is nothing hidden about Cromwell's exactly contemporary relationship with Barnes's colleague and admirer at the Cambridge Austin Friars, Friar Miles Coverdale. Coverdale became one of the most important among those creating Tudor England's vernacular Bible. His psalm translations are still those sung by Anglican choirs from the Book of Common Prayer. Between 1525 and 1527, certainly before he abandoned the order and fled the kingdom in 1528, Coverdale wrote two letters to Cromwell, which are remarkable for their fervently evangelical tone and their deep gratitude to Cromwell for his encouragement. Coverdale reminisced fondly in his first letter about his godly communication with Cromwell on Easter even, and asked for financial help. "Now I begin to taste of holy scriptures and godly savour of holy and ancient doctors." The tone is therefore both evangelical and humanist in its Renaissance sense. The writer is fascinated by the biblical text and the early theologians of the church, now readily available in good editions, many of them by the great editor Erasmus. Cromwell is cast in the role of humanist patron, whom Coverdale, your child and beadman in Jesu Christ, can address in elegant Latin without embarrassment, teasingly seeking a father's blessing like an unworthy son, as Jacob had done from the unsuspecting patriarch Isaac. A second letter is very similar in its warmth, its ready switching between Latin and English. It cheerfully conveys the latest scandal from Cambridge University. Thus, the Cromwell reflected in Coverdale's letters is a man versed in humanist culture, interested in what's been going on in Cambridge, and also happy to be addressed in the devotional rhetoric of the first generation of Tudor evangelicals. We should also note how both Coverdale and Barnes were at this time active in establishing and widening communications between East Anglian Lollards and the developing Reformation in mainland Europe, distributing books and introducing religious dissidents to each other from these two different worlds, native descent and university-based evangelicalism. It's the same pattern revealed through Thomas Cromwell's activities at Poffley Priory. The evidence for Cromwell's involvement in England's network of early evangelicals and even Lollards in the 1520s is therefore inescapable. Yet the paradoxes remain and will keep reappearing in these lectures. Back in 1517, Cromwell played a major part at Boston in promoting the very indulgence trade which in the same year sparked Martin Luther's wrath. And he then made his greatest career move so far on the basis of a spectacular project of soul provision for England's papal legate. How can we characterize this form of religion already forged in Cromwell's career in the 1520s? It is deceitful, certainly, hypocritical, perhaps, very different from the bold public proclamation that characterized the magisterial reformations of Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli, or John Calvin. At the time, Cromwell was frequently called a Lutheran, particularly by those who loathed the Reformation. But the reality of his religion is anything but Lutheran. Ultimately, its nearest relative in mainland Europe is Italian. Frequently, beginning with diatribes from Cardinal Reginald Poole, Cromwell has been called a disciple of Machiavelli, not least by his most indefatigable and imperceptive of biographers, R.B. Merriman. Another Florentine might be just as relevant, the reformer Girolamo Savonarola, who was burned at the stake after his brief dramatic dominance of Florence less than a decade before Cromwell knew the city. Savonarola's memory was still very much alive when Cromwell was there. But there is yet another Italian speciality contemporary with Cromwell's public career. Nicodemism, that quiet decision to hide one's religious views and practice among some degree of conformity to the surrounding official religion, as John Calvin pointed out sarcastically in coining this label. Nicodemus had only dared come to see the Saviour by night. The Nicodemites of the Italian Reform demonstrate many of the features of Thomas Cromwell's mature religious creed. Much that was outward did not reflect that which was inward. Perhaps we are looking at parallel Nicodemist developments here in Italy and England, because we found him in contact with Lollards since at least the mid-1520s. Nicodemism had been anticipated in the life and practice of Lollards from the early 15th century, sustained them through more than a century of persecution, so that some of them even held parish office in the church from which they dissented. A consciously Nicodemite outlook might explain the apparently stark contradiction between Cromwell's developing evangelicalism and his loyal service to that most grandiose of late medieval English churchmen, Thomas Wolsey. In Italy, such conjunctions were not at all unusual, while that paradoxical near miss, the Italian Reformation, took shape in the 1530s. One of Cromwell's Italian friends, Donato Rullo of Lecce and Venice, became just such a Nicodemite radical. Rullo was well acquainted with Juan de Valdés, the unmistakably heterodox theologian, refugee from Spain in Italy from the Spanish Inquisition. Valdés was the most distinguished and influential in the radical wing of those called spirituali, clerics and laypeople of varied theological creativity and Nicodemite tendency. Spirituale moved happily, if discreetly, in the clientage of exalted Italian churchmen, such as Gasparo Contarini or Giovanni Morone. Among such clerical magnates was also eventually to be numbered the Englishman, who also in the mid-1530s became a cardinal alongside Contarini and Morone, Reginald Poole. And he was another friend of Donato Rullo. These leading clergy, despite their frequently lavish lifestyles, represented hope for the future of a renewed and evangelical church. In the England of the 1520s, the best or speediest chance of reform in church and commonwealth alike was likewise at the hands of a cardinal of the Roman Church, the papal legate, Thomas Wolsey. Wolsey's general concern for justice and reform in the realm was exemplified in his activity as Lord Chancellor, And in his galvanizing the king's council to act more systematically as a court of law in Star Chamber. Wolsey spent a greater fraction of his energy than was politically sensible on prosecuting enclosures of arable land for pastures and legislating on enclosures. That was a personal crusade, infuriating some of the most powerful people in the land, clerical and lay, and it may have contributed to the enthusiasm many felt about his fall from grace in 1529. In the church, the cardinal had great plans for reorganization, rationalization of the English diocesan system, not merely for the educational fruits of his monastic suppressions, and for wider intervention and renewal in the orders of monks and friars. Relevant to Cromwell's present and future activities was that in November 1528, the cardinal secured two papal bulls for a radical renewal of English monastic life by suppressing all religious houses with fewer than 6 inmates and uniting communities of fewer than 12 to greater houses. If Wolsey had had the time to do that, the regular life in England would have been revolutionized. And what a feat of administration it would have been, worthy of Master Cromwell himself. Wolsey was remarkably easygoing on heresy compared with his English Episcopal brothers. He never initiated the burning of a heretic. In fact, after Bishop West of Ely, no less, had harassed the Cambridge Don, Hugh Latimer, in 1528 for what was already clearly outspoken evangelical preaching, Wolsey examined the offender. With open contempt for Bishop West, he granted Latimer a preaching license, which that voluble reformer defiantly continued to use despite conservative harassment after Wolsey's fall from power. This significant clash between Wolsey and a grand old man of the episcopal bench in the interests of Hugh Latimer is preserved in a circumstantial reminiscence by Ralph Morris, which John Fox found so difficult to fit into the architecture of his story that he decided not to use it. All of this made Wolsey detested by his colleagues on the episcopal bench. Indeed, it's remarkable how little support Wolsey had from the English bishops, and curious how little he was able to put his own men in among them. He had better success in the Lordship of Ireland. In 1529, the cardinal extended his energy to an unprecedented, if soon frustrated, effort at church reform in Ireland. Half a dozen monastic dissolutions included. This was spearheaded by his servant, Dr. John Allen, Cromwell's friend and colleague in the dissolution program in England, who had recently arrived as Archbishop of Dublin. Allen was assisted by Edward Staples, another of Wolsey's servants and lately a canon of Cardinal College, Oxford. Staples was now appointed Bishop of Meath, the most senior diocese in Ireland apart from its archbishoprics. Why should an evangelical not have hopes of all this? Yet Wolsey's handicap as church reformer, apart from personal self-indulgence, was the vast scope of his duties, not simply as papal legate, but also omnicompetent royal minister, dispenser of justice in Star Chamber and Chancery. It was all just too much. And there was also a personality defect about attention span. Wolsey's old physician, the Italian Dr. Augustine, reminded Cromwell of this after the cardinal's death, when Augustine was trying to wheedle some money out of a now much promoted former colleague. I quote, "I wish you would always remember what you were so often accustomed to say to me and others, that our right reverend master was so universally detested for nothing but putting things off for so long, and for his many words empty of deeds." Well, a cheap rhetorical shot, but it wouldn't have been worth chancing if it did not reflect an old reality. It's clear that for Cromwell, frustration long jostled with deep and lasting loyalty in his complex, intimate relationship with his master. while learning a great deal by observing Wolsey in government, drawing on Wolsey's initiatives and schemes, he did his best not to make the same mistakes in government once he was a great minister. And there is a further contradictory element we now need to add into the mix. Cromwell's relationship with Anne Boleyn. Now, in view of what happened in the 1530s, granted their shared enthusiasm for evangelical reform in religion, it's been natural to assume over the centuries that Cromwell and Anne were close allies. That was certainly the assumption of Anne's masterly modern biographer, Eric Ives, together with many contemporaries at the time, from the imperial ambassador Chapuys outwards, who loathed what the two of them represented in destroying the old church. In fact, however, Cromwell shows no sign of being Anne's enthusiastic partisan. Quite the reverse, as I will show in later lectures. His relationship with her was in marked contrast to Thomas Cranmer's relationship with her. Cranmer was always grateful that his road into royal service had been paved by the Boleyns. Cranmer's friend, Bishop Goodric of Ely, had an equally strong connection with the Boleyn family, and that might account for Cromwell's surprisingly cool relationship with Goodric that we've already noted. Now, the evidence that Eric Ives marshalled to suggest a more than formal nexus between Anne and Cromwell was surprisingly thin. Much of the evidence that does exist is ambiguous at best. For instance, Cromwell did indeed become high steward of her lands. But at £20 a year, his fee for this fairly routine and nominal honour was not overgenerous. And in any case, he had to pay substantial cash to obtain it. Anne's direct favours to Cromwell are distinctly difficult to identify, and there are downright disfavours. Very few letters from Anne survive in Cromwell's archive, and mostly they're formal pieces of administration. The sole example, soaked in the sort of evangelical jargon they both liked, is Anne's rather peremptory command to Cromwell to help an evangelical client of hers in Antwerp, Richard Harman by name. The letter manages to refer to the late cardinal as being responsible for Harman's troubles in a rather pointed manner, and certainly does not bother with that customary politesse whose soul God pardon. Ives suggested that Anne normally communicated by messenger, but an argument from silence always has its risks. There's actually a remarkable contrast between this paucity of letters between Anne and Cromwell and his considerable and increasingly warm and personal correspondence with another great lady, Princess Mary, with whom he allied during the process of Queen Anne's destruction. It's not surprising that any hostility between Anne and Cromwell did not receive publicity. Clashes were kept carefully out of sight until the final crisis of 1536, after which time it was in the interest of Protestant historians to smooth over this rather problematic relationship between the two heroes of early Protestant Reformation. The fact and the personality of Anne Boleyn were the greatest hindrances to a coherent evangelical bloc forming in England at the beginning of the 1530s. Few will doubt that she was a committed evangelical in religion and a great furtherer of the godly cause in her years of power. Together with her brother George, she was working in the same religious direction as both Cromwell and Cranmer. But as far as Cromwell was concerned, she was also the person most responsible for the destruction of his dear master, the cardinal. It was Cromwell's senior colleagues in Wolsey's service who smoothed the new man's way into the king's service in 1530, and they hated Anne Boleyn, even if some of them were prepared reluctantly to cooperate with the king's plans to marry her. Several were not, and sat out her reign until she was dead. Men like Sir John Gage or Sir John Russell, both of whom had put Cromwell into the king's service. Cromwell did cooperate in the king's great matter of the Boleyn marriage, but he also ended up successfully planning Anne's destruction in 1536. In fact, Anne was probably responsible for slowing Cromwell's rise to power. His eventual lead in her death is entirely understandable. Most evangelical leaders abroad, not least Martin Luther, regarded the king's campaign to marry Anne and discard Catherine as ridiculous, unjust, and cruel. Anne's removal then solved a good deal of the problem for English evangelicals. And then the shock of the Pilgrimage of Grace in 1536 suggested some very good reasons why they should try to stand in solidarity to avoid destruction at the hands of traditionalists. Well, we've not finished with the complications of Cromwell's religion. That will await my fourth lecture. But for the time being, I leave you with the revised opinion of Sir Geoffrey Elton, after a lifetime study of the man. At first, Elton had emphasized Cromwell's secularity. He differed little from the earlier biographer of Cromwell, R.B. Merriman, who said flatly of Cromwell that Catholicism and Protestantism passed over his head. He was not touched by either of them. By 1990, Elton had realized the idiocy of this judgment. He allowed that Cromwell certainly had a view of God, the church, and the faith, which must be called religious. It is wrong to think of him as a fully secular person. What marks him was a freedom from instinctive conventional reactions, a freedom probably obtained in his peculiar adolescence and confirmed by the essential rationalism of his mind. Well, that is almost as much a description of Geoffrey Elton himself as of his lifelong subject, and a good one. But it's only halfway down the road in unraveling Thomas Cromwell, and we shall travel further down that road in the next three lectures. Thank you.